Welcome to the Forging Honor Podcast. I'm Jonathan George.
And I'm Benjamin Jones. Here at The Forge, we explore what it means to live as Christian men. Along the way, we'll be doing weekly challenges to build character through action. We are by no means experts, just two young Christian men trying to make sense of a wild world.
That's right. We do our best to learn and hope you'll join us on the journey. And if you want to get directly involved, go to forginghonor.com to find information on how to join our community.
This is episode 25. Dissecting the Frog.
All right, challenge wrap-up time. As a reminder, challenges last for 10 days. That's Monday through Friday for 2 weeks. They are simple daily tasks to grow us as men. This previous challenge was Banjo's brainchild. Essentially, go learn comedy, learn how to tell a joke, study the comedians. Banjo, how'd you do?
This was not far afield for me. I did 10 out of 10 and joyfully so. This was like I really, you know, we set the challenges up for ourselves, and my wife usually makes fun of me for it because she's like, how can it really be a challenge if it's something you want to do? This was a week where I was like, yeah, she's right.
I was thinking about it going, I don't know if this one actually hits all of our criteria just because I don't know how much this grows us as men. I hope in a good way.
I'm excited to talk about it. I think there's a lot to talk about. I have a lot of questions to ask you that I think are going to be interesting. We're going to have at least one fight. Which I think should be good. But how about you? How did you do?
I did 6 of the 10, and a few of those days I almost didn't. I just almost forgot. I'm not like you with this. It's not natural for me to go seek this stuff out necessarily.
So did you – well, sorry, you keep going, keep going.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, did you grow up with comedians? Was this a form that you were familiar with or
– Not particularly stand-up comedy. Or anything like that, or even comedy movies. I didn't really grow up with, I think my biggest exposure to comedy was like sketch comedy of the early 2010s, right? At that age where I guess early, like middle school, early high school for me, where YouTube was really starting to blow up at the time.
That would have been
2000, mm-hmm. 2009, 2010, somewhere in there.
Were you a Vines guy?
I remember Vines. I loved Vines. Those were awesome.
I didn't do Vines.
I didn't do Vines
because I from the age of 7 I was obsessed with stand-up comedians. And so when I saw Vines, I was like, that's not a joke.
That's the thing. It's like, what makes a joke? Mm-hmm. And so that was part of our study.
Yeah.
So I grew up, it wasn't just Vines, but it was did you ever watch ASDF or ASDF, as it's called, just those first four letters on the middle row of the keyboard.
Oh, I think so. Once or twice.
Yeah. They were like these little, that was like peak, was that like 8th grade for me? Like just peak comedy at the time. There were these little stick figure thing drawings that just did mm-hmm. funny stuff. And it was hilarious. I think there, the comedy is more than just like it's more than just a 6-second blip because there's callbacks and there's ways that it intermingles, but also it is very quick jokes, very rapid fire. So it's definitely different than that. And then the sketch comedy, as I mentioned, there's just some really great stuff from that era the camera quality, terrible. You know, it's these two, whatever, college students or high schoolers trying to make this hilarious. There's just little things like that I really enjoyed.
Were you an SNL guy? Did you Saturday Night
Live?
No,
not really SNL. I'd say as far as like the bigger studios go, the biggest it ever got for me was like Studio C, like the Christian version. You know, they're not even Christian; they're Mormon, I think. And someone's been committing for that.
You and I had two totally different comedic upbringings then.
Mm-hmm.
Totally different.
The rest of my comedy that wasn't like on YouTube. Pretty much all books, and then
funny writers
like
Wodehouse.
We had an audiobook of Wodehouse that we listened to when we drove down the road, and it was all the Jeeve stuff. trying to think if there's anything else that was particularly humorous. Shoot, I should have sat down and thought through some of this a little more as far as authors that have influenced me in that regard.
I think but even the way you say that was kind of like, I don't remember anything particularly humorous. It's like, it's like you're trying to remember your medical family history. You're like, I think we had a joke back in the 2000s. You know, I had an uncle who was funny, but
that's pretty much. Well, so here's the thing. My family as a whole has cultivated this very dry humor.
Okay.
And this very, like, I consider my father to be one of the funniest people I know.
Okay.
Sitting around the dinner table, no one's cracking up laughing. It's later we're all like, oh, that was hilarious. And we laugh about it, you know, 3 days later because it all finally clicks with us what he was trying to get across. Mm-hmm. And I think he takes joy in that. He takes joy in weaving a joke that requires time to figure out.
Right.
My grandfather is the same
very
way.
Very British.
It's true. Well, I think that's part of it. My both he and my mother grew up reading a lot of British and then early American authors as well, who were still being influenced by that in some ways. I personally have found like even the works of Lewis to be hilariously funny. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's like there's something going on there that's different than a stand-up comedian.
Oh yeah. But it is Lewis is very funny.
He's hilarious. Chesterton is even more like Screwtape Letters. Yeah. I laughed out loud multiple times reading that book. Like there was my young life was not entirely devoid of humor. But my grandfather
that's how his memoir began. My young life was not entirely devoid of humor.
See, and this is so I'm already noticing because you're thinking about stand-up, you're immediately mm-hmm. doing what you do, which is
I'm doing my bits. Yeah.
You want to do your bits.
This is,
I think that's a big difference. You'll always put on a voice. You'll always do the stand up bits. And I much prefer to be like just straight deadpan to the point.
Well, I don't always do the voice. I think the voice is helpful on the podcast.
Fair enough.
Because it's like, you know, nobody's seeing our faces. And so the voice helps. But like when I'm in class, when I'm teaching my students, my favorite thing is just to go right by it and do what your dad does and just come across with like a kid will say something and I will say something that none of the kids will get. None
exactly.
of them. And then like one of them at the end of class will get this look on their face like, wait a minute, did he say that like 20
said
minutes
that
ago?
To me.
He said
that. Like, exactly.
Or what's really funny is this week we're doing a unit in sarcasm with my 10th graders. And so I've allowed sarcasm in the classroom as you know, I say if you're using sarcasm, obviously you're learning something, which was sarcastic. But
I did see that SNL bit.
So it's a good one.
Yeah.
But be anyway, more global. So one of the kids goes, I gave some example of sarcasm. And one of the kids goes, isn't sarcasm supposed to be funny? And then I said, like you? And so it's that kind of a thing where the whole.
Just back and forth. Yeah, you get into it.
So I'm an eclectic. I bring a smorgasbord of comedy to the table. Did you grow up with the Muppets at all?
Didn't watch the Muppets till I was probably like a senior in high school.
Okay.
No,
yeah.
My comedy upbringing was lacking, you could say. I'm sorry, Banjo. I'm sorry to have failed you so early, so young.
I think of you as a very funny person. You know, I enjoy our conversations because I laugh. I think that's part of the deal. But I have realized that I have a really what's growing to be a niche sense of humor. Like I remember when Vines and when what was the thing that came after Vines? There was like a sequel to Vines that was popular, but it wasn't as good. I can't remember what it was now. Anyway, that like
everybody's adopted that now with Instagram Reels and
right
YouTube Shorts.
That short form humor never appealed to me because I was I grew up on this like stand up. And like SNL, I love a good SNL sketch, and all those things. But I don't think that's a really popular form anymore. Maybe at least among, I'd say, like the younger kids. Like, I don't see younger kids getting into it. I don't know about our age. I think there was like probably an upswing with comedians like John Mulaney, and guys like him that are recently coming up that I think got like, that was really in the bloodstream in college, I remember. So that was, did you find, you watched John Mulaney in college?
Oh yeah.
You found him funny?
Again, I didn't seek him out. Someone would put him on in a room. I thought he was pretty funny. My issue with most stand-up comedians, and it's the same for John Mulaney, is it's they cross more lines than I'm generally willing to cross in terms of their content. That said, like, I get why, like, they'll make the arguments why they need to cuss, why they need to cross the line to all the sexual stuff, etc. Get it. I just don't see the need for it, because I think there's so much other good humor out there. Like, you don't need to go for pure shock value, right? And half the time, it feels like if they're doing that, they're using it for the shock value, not because it's actually a good joke.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you look at a joke and you break it down, and the punchline is actually the cuss word, it's not a very good joke.
Exactly.
You know, that's not – so that's why I appreciate guys like Jerry Seinfeld or Jim Gaffigan or Brian Regan, who put the constraint on themselves of like, I'm going to be a clean comedian. And I'm going to focus on that.
Right.
And they're like, and because of that, they are, I think they're much funnier, because often their jokes are just timeless. You know, it's like,
exactly.
It's always true that this is the case, you know? Right. And I think if you hang your hat on making the joke the curse word, then it's just not as funny. But I see a lot of kids, or I've seen a lot of kids, and I'm not talking about my students now, I'm talking about kids I grew up with, who thought that the punchline was the cuss word, and that the cuss words themselves were funny. And I think that gets to something that I kind of want to talk about, is like, I don't quite know how to phrase this properly, but it's hard to tell a joke. It's harder to tell a joke than it looks. And I think it takes a lot of skill and practice. And I've seen a lot of guys struggle with finding what's funny and figuring out what's actually funny and figuring out how to make other people laugh. But it's such an addictive thing. Like, once you figure out how to get someone to laugh, like, oh, it's the best feeling in the world. I think, personal opinion.
I was about to say, for you, maybe.
Yeah. For me.
I think there is, to some extent, in any friend group, like, those are the best times when everybody's laughing. We're all cracking jokes. And that's great times. I wouldn't say that necessarily any one of us would be considered, you know, the quote unquote class clown necessarily or anything like that.
No, no. But what does make you laugh? Let's start there. What does make you laugh?
I think it's the same thing as anybody else. A combination of timing, really. I think that's the number one thing is timing. You could tell the funniest joke in the world, but if you tell it the wrong way, the wrong time, you just sandwich all the lines together, it's not going to be funny. I think the other piece of that is, as with any good writing, turning ideas on their head, or coming up with the unexpected, or taking a quick about face, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I find that hilarious. You know, I will say, you were telling me, I hadn't really watched a ton of Jim Gaffigan. I watched some more of his. And one thing I noticed he always did was he would just go for the most unexpected line.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And like, he had this bit, just, or it's these lines and these comparisons. Like, he had this bit about a bear coming at him.
Yeah.
And about how the bear probably thought, like, that he, Jim Gaffigan, was this giant land salmon. Like, it's the greatest day ever. And there's just ways where he just, you know, he kind of hones in on that idea a little bit, and he just keeps coming up with the unexpected. And you should go watch the bit. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
And I will never do it justice. my point
that's,
being,
that's one of the keys of a great joke, though. I was listening to another comedian who was talking about, his Mike Birbiglia. He was talking about the best comedians, when they tell a joke, if you try to retell the joke, you always mess it up.
Exactly.
And you always, it's whoever wrote the joke or whoever performed the joke, you have to go see them do it, you know?
Right.
Because they're the ones who are able to pull it off. Anyway, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Well, I think, so those are the main things, you know, timing and then the unexpected, which presenting the unexpected, it's all timing again.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, people talk about like what makes stuff funny. I was looking that up, you know, what really makes anything funny. I mean, no one really knows. You
know, nobody people talk knows. About like it's they like know. Fire. We just found it and we've carried fire, around.
Fire, we
since.
Totally know how that works though, Banjo. So your analogy completely falls flat. Like,
okay. Smart anyway. Guy. Figuring out fire. You were the guy in the caves who was like, no, we figured it out.
Like,
you
guys,
the stones
science
together.
Is settled. Here's how this works.
And all the rest of us were like, I don't know, witch doctor. I think we got to knock him out. He's giving out the secrets.
See, Banjo, you're trying to run away with this and turn it into your own stand-up comedy routine. I'm not going to let that happen. We have a podcast to discuss.
The integrity of this show will be maintained.
And there you go again. Careful.
I promised myself at the beginning, I said, I will not be funny. I'm not going to make this about me.
You are succeeding so well.
And then the egomania came out. It's like the microphone is a magnet. No, but with your point to the unexpected, it's so much of what good humor is, irony. It's subverting expectations and just and drawing connections between like totally unrelated things. But your joke made me think of Seinfeld has a bit where he talks about there was these invasive moose species somewhere in Canada or something like that. And so they had to helicopter in and pull the moose out of the land where it was and take it somewhere else, transport it somewhere else. So his joke was they would take like harnesses, put it down, hook it under the moose without, you know, nobody's down there. It just goes on hooks under the moose and then just starts to carry the moose up into the air. And so he goes, can you imagine that from the moose perspective? He just is standing there minding his own business. And then all of a sudden he goes, well, I guess I can fly now. I'm Super Moose. I'm going to go all moose crime.
There you go.
and then he goes, and then he's trying to move from side to side a little bit, trying to steer it. And he goes, well, I guess I haven't figured that out yet. I did just get these powers today.
There you go. See, that is legitimately funny. I mean, it's a funny image on its own. A moose just being
on its face. It's great, right?
And he's taking something funny and he's relating it to Superman. Yeah, exactly. Like that. I don't know why that's hilarious though. Like, why is it funny to us? It's. I think it's again combination of how you tell it, the timing, and then the actual content being somewhat unexpected, which is why I think people go for the shock value of sexual content and cuss words.
Oh yeah.
Which, that to say, I will say there are some bits I have found completely insanely hilarious from folks like Bill Burr and Dave Chappelle, who are known for being very crass. That said, I you could strip down their jokes and tell them in a way without some of the crass.
I really think because
most of the time the punchline isn't the crass bit. They just happen to be crass people telling these jokes.
Yeah. And I think there's two roles for comedians in society. I think one is just getting us to see, and I think these are like the Jim Gaffigans and the Brian Regans of the world, you know, just getting us to see, you know, not to take ourselves too seriously and to start drawing connections between different things. Like to see, oh wait, I hadn't thought of it this way before. The other role, I think, which is related, the other role of the comedian, I think, is like the truth teller, or I often think of them as like the prophets, like somebody like George Carlin, if you've ever seen them. I think Dave Chappelle does this too, where they look at kind of what's underneath society. They talk about what's kind of underneath society and say, hey, look, we're all pretending that this isn't true. We're all pretending that this isn't there, but it is, and there's consequences to it. You know, like George Carlin had a bit about like words and why words are important. And so he would go through and he would like list all of these different words that have like changed over the years. So like he was talking about like the origins of PTSD. He says people come back home from war in World War One, and back then everybody, it was like big words, big powerful words, shell shock, right? Big words, you can feel them, right? Shell shock. And then you move on, it gets a little bit farther, you get into World War II, and now instead of shell shock, it's battle fatigue, right? A few more syllables, it's getting a little bit softer. And then he kind of like takes it all the way to post-traumatic stress disorder. See, it's got the humanity taken right out of it. You know,
right. And so no more feeling.
By the time you get to it, you see how we use language in modern life to kind of mask all of the real meaning in what is there. So anyway, I think comedians, even like Dave Chappelle and Bill Burr, are worth listening to on occasion, not because they tell crass jokes, but because, you know, Dave Chappelle is magnificently funny at pointing out the hypocrisy of modern life. Like that's what 100%. He's good at.
I mean, that you were sounding suspiciously like Jordan Peterson there for a minute about the whole profits thing and Dave Chappelle. That's something Jordan Peterson has directly said. which, by the way, I did see this
clock twice a day.
There you go. I did see a bit pop up on my YouTube feed. It was Theo Von interviewing Jordan Peterson, or I don't know who was interviewing who. Honestly, one's a psychologist, so. Anyway,
they're both crazy.
They're both, but it was incredible. The interaction itself was funny because right. Jordan Peterson is such a serious analytical person. You know, he wants to walk through everything step by step, logically, if this, therefore that, et cetera, et cetera. And so Jordan Peterson's talking about, you know, if you have these self-centered thoughts and you're dreaming these things and you're, et cetera. Yeah, like he's going down this path, and Theo Von just like, yeah, like if you're worried, one leg's longer than the other, and just leaves it at that. Like, no, like he gets, it's amazing. I haven't seen Peterson laugh like that before. Just out of the blue, Theo Von just dead serious about the dumbest thing in the world. Just,
yeah,
you know, and that's the interaction of these two characters was pretty incredible. If you haven't seen it, it's worth looking at. I think because it shows, like, they don't even have to the jokes themselves aren't even that funny. It's just the total contrast of these personalities. Like right. You could not find two more different people.
Right. Yeah.
But it's incredible to watch them have this conversation. And I think that's a huge part of it is that contrast and unexpected kind of what you're saying, riding on the edge, figuring out, pushing that barrier a little bit.
The contrast, the unexpected. I mean, I love like the old screwball comedy from, you know, like the 70s and 80s, where it's like there's like all these visual gags that are just crazy. Like I remember one, I don't remember what movie this is in, but it's like it's a spoof on a war movie, and in the front of the camera, in the front of the frame, you can see like a really big rotary phone, and it's clearly big because it's you know, it's in the forefront, and far away you can see the you can see like the war room desk where everybody's like gathered around the maps and they're talking, and the phone rings and a general turns around and starts walking towards the phone. But as he's walking towards the phone, you realize that the image isn't right. And then he gets up next to the phone and he picks it up and it's as big as he is. And they've just fooled you with the foreshadowing and or with with the foregrounding. And I love that kind of contrast because it's just so funny because we know what's supposed to happen there. We know what that is supposed to be. And then it's just totally broken in the best possible way. You know, like, you know, for all of its warts, like the movie Airplane is like that. I don't know if you've ever seen that one.
I couldn't finish it. It was
too crass or too.
For one, I sat down to watch it with my wife and not with a bunch of buddies. Neither of us had ever seen it. So there's that.
Okay. Yeah.
And for two, I think there was just something about like the way the jokes unfold. It just maybe if I'd watched it when I was younger, like at this point, everything's been redone. Right. Now that just feels like, like The Matrix feels this way, like the movie The Matrix. We sat down to watch it our first year of marriage because neither of us had ever seen The Matrix. And we went, wow, we can see every other movie since this movie came out, all the action unfolding, every bit of it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that makes this movie look dull and boring now, right? This right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I get it. I get
and,
it.
And
you're wrong, but I get it.
Well, you can, I can, I can fully acknowledge The Matrix had a huge impact. I can see how so many movies took influence from it. And I can see how if I had watched it at the time, I would have thought it was the most amazing thing ever.
Yeah. Unfortunately, no, I get it.
I have since seen Iron Man and Captain America and all the other, you know, everything else that has drawn on it, John Wick, et cetera. So.
Yeah. Part of the reason that this is shifting gears a little bit, but part of the reason I was thinking about this challenge was that I've realized how seriously lately I've been taking myself. Like in all that I
just
do,
lately,
just lately. Well, yeah. I don't know. I get in spots where I'm like, oh, I am the center of the known universe and everyone's just waiting for me to bloom. That's just it.
That's my problem.
That's my problem. One of these days I'll bloom and everything will be solved, you know? And when you do that, A, you're not funny. I mean, people can laugh at you, but they're certainly not laughing with you. And B, like existence gets like awful dreary, awful quick. Cause it's like, you know, the weight of the world is on your shoulders. And I feel like somewhere along the way, I lost my sense of humor a little bit. And so I was just reflecting on, maybe this is more personal in general, but I used to watch stand-up comedians all the time. That was like a regular occurrence. It's like once a week, at least I'm watching some sort of stand-up.
It's a lot of comedy.
Oh, yeah, I love it. The writing to me is so phenomenally good. Like what I love is writing that can move you. I don't care if it's writing that makes you cry or like makes you inspired. Like the kinds of things I love to watch are like the locker room speech, you know, the pre-war battle, the funeral eulogy, you know, and stand-up comedy, which are all kind of the same thing. They're trying to bring out this emotion.
They're basically identical. Like John Mulaney at your funeral, everything's going to go great. You know,
could you ask for anything more?
Maybe not you, Banjo.
But for me, I've been getting away from the comedy and the comedians, and I feel, I've felt great returning to these things. It was a breath of fresh air for me, for someone who's been taking himself too seriously, like getting to listen to these people whose job it is to not take themselves seriously was really helpful.
That's interesting because I feel that way when I go back and read like Lord of the Rings, which, you know, in this last year I have not spent anywhere near as much time in as I've wanted to. And I sat down and read a few chapters the other day. I was just like, whoa, I forgot how much I loved this, how much I really, really loved this, especially as a high schooler and early college student. So I definitely, what you're saying about kind of getting away from something that you knew and then you're getting back to it, I think that can be a huge part of it. Like there was a piece of identity formed at one point.
Yeah.
Which I hate that word, but anyway.
Well, I mean, in some ways it's an accurate statement. Like it was the thing that I remember the very first time I heard stand up. I was like 6 or 7. My parents were driving us back from some big event, and I was driving up Lookout Mountain in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And was going up, and my parents, it was late at night, my parents thought all of us were asleep, so they put on a Brian Regan CD, a Brian Regan set of his stand up. Have you listened to Brian Regan? You know who that
nope.
is? Oh, I think you'd like him. He's very funny. Very clean comedian. Very good. Anyway, from like the jump, from like the first lines, I was cracking up laughing in the back seat and just immediately memorized every word that came out of his mouth because it was so funny. Yeah. I was like, this is the craziest thing. And then like 2 nights later, my parents went out on a date or something like that. And we had these babysitters and they knew who Brian Regan was. And so I was like seven. I started doing the bits for the high school babysitters.
That's incredible.
And I was doing the voice And the girls were just cracking up. They were laughing and laughing. And I was like, this is awesome.
This is how it works. This is how life works for Little Band Show.
This is it. I can do this. And yep. Like a core piece of who I was, like from that moment. I mean, it was just, that's what it was. It's like, I memorized that CD. I can still probably do like 80% of that CD.
You probably do it all the time without me knowing.
Probably.
Like, I remember I watched some Seinfeld for the first time, and I was like, This is half of Banjo. Like, literally, wait a minute. I'm on to him now.
That's my secret. I go and watch TV from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, download them into my personality because nobody has seen them. And then they're like, wow, that Banjo is really funny and original. I'm not. I just have good resource material.
Like, wow, his jokes are really old.
Yeah. So anyway, it's a really core part to me. And I think because I love comedy so much, I feel like it's important for other people. I feel like this is something Christian men should have. Because I think it's just as important as, you know, how do you do a job interview well? I think you got to be able to tell a joke well. I was talking about this with my father-in-law over Thanksgiving. We were grilling the turkey together, which was an adventure in and of itself. But we were grilling, enjoying a cigar, some wine. And I asked him, I said, what do you, you know, or I said, we're talking about thinking about comedy this week and how important, my father-in-law is a pastor. I said, how important do you think it is for pastors to understand comedy? Like how much of a role do you think that plays in preaching a sermon? And he's like, oh, I think it's really important. Because part of telling a joke, there's so much timing and delivery and performance that goes into it. And in order to do a joke well, you have to master A, what you're writing, B, how you're saying it, and like every element of it. Like you were saying at the beginning, like you have to get the timing down. That's no accident.
Right.
Like a joke told well is like a Swiss watch. But you also have to get like every word needs to be in the right place and in the right order, you know, and it should get a result. And part of what I love about telling a joke is that if it's funny, you're going to laugh. And if it's not funny, you won't.
Exactly.
It's so black
People
and white.
People don't fake that.
You can't fake a laugh. I mean, you can, but it's so obvious. You know, it's most of what you do to me on a regular basis. You fake the laugh, and I know
Sure, Banjo. Yeah, yeah. I have to make my co-host feel somewhat decent about himself, considering how down you get. this whole podcast is just Operation Keep Banjo Happy. I will laugh at your jokes for you, Banjo.
Oh, don't mind me. I'll get along fine.
Oh, Eeyore.
Could be worse. Don't know how, but it could. Yeah.
Pretty much.
That's me. Anyone who knows me, that's my.
You know, what's funny about you were saying about comedy being a science. I did hear, this was a while ago. I can't even remember who it was. It was over a year ago. I listened to an interview with the comedian. I'd need to go back and check which podcast it was and even find it. But the thing that I remember sticking out to me was she was talking about how it with her sets at one point, I can't remember if it was her husband or someone who is in, you know, more interested in the stat side of stuff,
right,
went through all of her shows and wrote down like which jokes got laughs, how big the laughs were. They came up with a rating, like a 1 through 5 of how big a laugh was from the audience, etc., and then just started categorizing all her jokes and then built a set to kind of have a, you know, small joke, like build up, really big one, and then small, you know, little, the medium, and then build up. You know, there's this pattern to it, essentially, to kind of keep the audience hooked in. And she said the funny thing was when they started doing that, and she really got to know it, she knew exactly, like, she could tell the audience, like, if it went well, everything was hitting her script in terms of, oh, I'm getting my small jokes, right? And what was interesting to me was she wasn't going for a big one every single time, right?
No,
every joke is not the funniest joke that's ever been told. You get a lot of little laughs to lead up to the big punchline.
Right.
And that punchline is leading up to maybe a bigger one later, right? In the few specials I've watched, a big thing they do is the callbacks, and that you're building everything up as you get to it, and it's this whole, you're weaving everything in, and it's like, I don't know, it's like reading a good essay. Everything's woven in, it's great and it's beautiful. And
yeah, for, by the way, for watching the master of the callback, watch Mike Birbiglia. His new special, The Old Man in the Pool, is especially, it has one of the best endings of a stand-up set I have ever seen.
All right.
I was floored.
I'm going to have to check that out. Anyway. I did like what I saw of Birbiglia. He has an interesting style. It is funny. Every comedian has their own just very distinct delivery style.
It's so different.
And like Jim Gaffigan looks like he's like deer in the headlights all the time, like the entire time.
Yeah.
Like what are you concerned? He's like always shying back from, like, I don't know. I don't understand what he's scared of, but
yeah.
And I don't know. I could go on, but it's funny how that influences their comedy as well in terms of the timing and delivery.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, I that's interesting and I want to get back to that, but Aaron Sorkin is one of my favorite writers. He's not comedic, but he's one of my favorite writers. And he talks about any speech, you know, any written work that is spoken before an audience he says it has all the qualities of music. And so he treats his dialogue in his TV shows and in his movies like music, with the short note, long note, rest. You know, you have to have all of those beats, quarter notes, half notes. He doesn't write it all out, but that's how he treats it.
Right, right.
And I think the way that I see stand-up comedy is like one long jazz solo in that regard. It's like one person is getting up there and they are using their instrument and they are getting everything out of it by themselves most of the time. And it's all about, like, I'm going to do this joke, but then I'm going to leave a long pause. And then I'm going to maybe let the audience get to the punchline before I do. Mike Birbiglia does this sometimes, where he'll like say a thing and the audience figures out like what's going on and they start to laugh, and he like keeps holding on to the pause and they are laughing more and more because he's not actually saying the punchline. He's like building up the tension around it.
That's funny. Yeah.
Almost like a jazz drummer would just like do the snares and just like keep it going until finally you get the riff, you know. Or, but somebody like Jim Gaffigan, you know, he manages to play like two instruments at the same time, because he'll do his regular joke and then he'll do his like little voice where he makes fun of himself, like, oh, that wasn't funny, you know, that sort of a thing.
Right.
So it's almost like he's doing two things at once. And it's one of those things I really appreciate about stand-up comedians is the way that they hear speech as music. Like, they know that their voice is musical. They know that they have that effect. And I don't know, I think that's something that, especially, you know, anybody who has to get up and speak in front of people, I think that's something that they can learn from a comedian, is like, okay, listen to the music, hear yourself talk, and realize that every element of what you do has an effect on people. And I just think that's really fascinating.
Yeah, I don't have much to say to that, but yes, I think you're right.
So do you have a joke, either like, not necessarily a stand-up joke, but like any joke that you love that you've grown up with?
Just like any old joke?
Any old joke.
I mean, no. Like, there's...
or a line that your dad said, maybe?
No, the number one... the only thing I can recall is... my mom used to ask us, you know, when is a door not a door?
When it's a jar.
Yeah. And we would all laugh. And it wasn't until I was like 14 or 15 that I finally got the joke. And we've been saying it for a decade. One day, I walked into the kitchen and was like, Mama, that is, it all makes sense now, everything.
Okay.
So like, and that's one of those things where like, that's just the family joke. Everybody always says it.
You always
know.
Say that one.
But like, I wouldn't say that. I mean, just a pun. I will say like, I do like
nothing
a good pun.
Wrong with puns. Nothing.
I do like
puns.
A good pun. There's this one I've seen this one before, but I saw it again recently there's this flower shop. They always post jokes on their billboard and they change once a week. So when we're driving home from church, we pass this little flower shop and they've got their billboard up. And the one this last week was puns about steaks, a rare medium. Well done.
That's good.
That's a good one right there, isn't it? So I thought that one was pretty funny. I like a good pun. I think that it's more the sense of humor.
Yeah.
More than it is any one particular joke. Subtle lines. I was realizing I didn't mention the Andy Griffith Show, something I grew up on.
Classic. Yep.
And the comedy there can be somewhat situational. You know, you have Barney and he's hilarious, right?
He's
got his hilarious moments. I was watching some of it recently and realizing Andy himself is the real comedy mastermind.
Oh, he's genius.
I did not realize, like as a kid, Barney's the funny guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm realizing Andy just has all these lines. Like he'll just say something slightly off. And you're just like, I think that's what I've inherited from my family more than anything else.
Yeah.
Anyway, was there a place you were going with that, Banjo, or are you, do you have something?
No, well, I was just curious because, you know, I think just as like the way that a comedian tells a joke is like, oh, that's unique to them, you know.
Very much so, yeah.
What you find funny is also subjective, you know, it's unique to you, you know. So I think you can learn a lot about a person, and I don't mean like in a psychological way, like, oh, he thought this was funny. It's just like, I think you learn a lot about a person by understanding what makes them laugh and what they think is funny. You know, I think all of my friendships have required humor. Like I can't think of a single friend I have who I'm like, yeah, we don't tell jokes. Like I think that's always been like a gateway into a relationship for me. It's like, if I can make you laugh, then we're going to be friends. Like this is going to work out.
Yeah.
And if I can't make you laugh, if you don't have the same sense of humor as me, it's not going to work. I can tell you that, you know, the people that I have like hard times with where I'm like, hey, I don't really want to deal with that person. It's because they don't have the same sense of humor, or they don't have a sense of humor, which is worse. And you know, not that those people don't matter. They matter. They're important. They're important people. But it's just more fun to laugh, you know. My grandfather has always been like, both of my grandfathers really are very, very funny. My dad's dad will like tell jokes. And then my mom's dad just kind of makes fun of people in like these really great ways. He'll just kind of like say the thing that just is a perfect zing. But my dad's dad told me the first joke I ever remember, and it still kills me. He says, so you have five, if I have $5 in one pocket and $5 in another pocket, what do I got?
I don't know. What, 10 bucks?
Somebody else's pants on.
That's a good one. I have heard that before.
That's one of my favorites. It's just so, I mean, talk about like unexpected, like the setup there is so clear and the payoff is so, it's so unexpected. It's great. But the joke I love that I think about all the time is there's this boy I love. Mm-hmm. I won't tell any of my hairy dog stories, but those are my favorite. Boy. I love the jokes that go on for like 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then have like the dumbest punchline. That kills me.
You know,
every
time. I assume then you know the one about the monk, like the guy in the monastery. Yeah, that's a good one. I have used that one before.
Yes, you have used
that. Everyone groans every time.
I remember you telling me that joke.
Oh, really? You hadn't heard it before that?
I think so. Yeah, I think you were the first.
That's funny.
By the way, folks should absolutely feel free to send us their favorite jokes. I would love to hear.
I will laugh at them.
Please send it in the Discord. Do we have an email? We need an email. We have a Twitter account.
I think there's one on the website. We do have Twitter.
Send it to our Twitter. What's our Twitter handle there, JJ?
I think just Forging Honor.
Forging Honor. Look us up. We would love to laugh this week. But one of my favorite jokes says this boy. I probably told you this one before, JJ, but pretend this is your first time.
Okay. I'll do my best. it's not the fifth audience. I swear.
He goes to the summer camp. This boy goes to the summer camp and it's his first time away from home. And so he's really nervous and he goes into the lunchroom, lunchtime, and everybody's sitting down and he gets invited over to a table. So he sits down with these kids. And he makes friends with this one guy. And so they're sitting there and they're talking. And then all of a sudden, one guy stands up in the back of the room and he goes, 22. And everyone bursts into laughter. Everyone's laughing. Somebody else stands up and they go, 16. Everyone's dying. It's everyone just on the floor. Somebody else stands up and goes, 73. More laughter. Everyone's just cracking up all over the place. And the kid is so confused. He's like, what's going on? So he turns to his new friend. He says, why is everybody laughing? What's the deal? And he goes, well, so we have a camp library and it's got all these books, but we only have one joke book. So everybody in the camp has read the one joke book and we've all heard the jokes a million times. So now to save time, instead of telling the whole joke, we just say what number it is. And that's all. We just move on.
Yeah.
And the guy goes, oh, that's pretty great. So he, after lunch and after free time, he goes to the library and he goes and he picks up the joke book and he looks through it. He finds a couple that he thinks are pretty good. So he memorizes the number and he's all excited. So he goes back to lunch. He goes back to dinner the next meal and he's ready. Everybody's sitting there. It's quiet. There's a lull. Somebody stands up and goes, 65. Everyone cracks up. Somebody else comes around and goes, 47. More laughter. Finally, the kid gets up. He's all excited. He goes, 12. Nothing. Dead silence. Nobody says anything. He's blushing. He's beet red. He sits back down and he turns to the guy next to him and he goes, what happened? I thought that was a pretty good joke. He goes, you didn't tell it right.
See, so that joke, actually, you're not the first one to tell me that. First time I heard that joke, Banjo, which that has layers to it. The first time I heard it, I was like, I don't know, 8 or 9. And I didn't understand the whole concept of timing.
Right, right.
And there was this older gentleman that was a friend of the family, and he told that joke only instead of a little boy, it was a man, and instead of a camp, it was prison. I remember being just like this completely like what and just puzzling over that for ages and ages, and yeah. My dad thought it was pretty hilarious how much I had to puzzle over it.
No,
that's funny.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a terrible joke, but it's funny.
I think it's great. There's another one. Don Rickles was a famous comedian back in like the 70s or whatever. He was friends with Frank Sinatra. Mm-hmm. And they were big time guys. So, you know, Don Rickles he's at a club in Vegas and Sinatra's coming by and Rickles says, hey, I'm meeting this girl later for dinner. It would really mean a lot if you would come by. It would really, you know, it'd really seal the deal if you came by and you know, introduced yourself, you know, because you're such a big star, Frank. It would be such an honor if you came by. So Don Rickles goes to the town. Frank says, all right, you know, I'll do it. I'd be glad to do it for you, Don. I'll be happy. So Don Rickles is sitting with the girlfriend and Frank rolls up all high in mind. He's all excited.
All
Sinatra. He goes, hey, Don. And then Don Rickles turns around to Frank and goes, get out of here, Frank. Can't you see I'm busy?
Oh my goodness.
I thought you'd like that one.
Yeah, that's funny. That's good.
So what do you, you know, we're coming up on the end of the hour. Do you feel like, was this just a massive waste of time or Is there something you feel like, okay, we can come away from this challenge as better men, knowing this about ourselves or about comedy? Or
is this
just a vacation episode?
It was not a total waste of time, Banjo.
Forging Honor, a total waste of time.
I have a friend at the end of random sentences, such as, it was a total waste of time. He likes to tag, that's what they said at the Alamo. Or anything vaguely hopeful, I think it'll work out, that's what they said at the Alamo. And I think that's probably my favorite joke, personally. Back, just kind of the favorite joke thing. So in that sense, this whole thing was a bit of a waste of time, because I already know my favorite joke, and it's the unexpected, out of the blue, when I'm talking to my friend, that's what they said at the Alamo, after I've just told him my plans for the weekend.
I think it'll be okay.
That's what they said at the Alamo. I tell them, oh, we're going to make just a quick trip out to my family's for Christmas. Well, you know, oh, that's what they said at the Alamo. Like, just a quick trip.
I don't think those are Mexicans. That's what they said at the Alamo.
There you go. Anyway. So that always lives pretty rent-free in my head, and I use it randomly. Again, in that sense, I'm not sure how much is to be gained by, as you said, dissecting the frog with all of this. At the same time, I think it is worth at least being like, yeah, it's okay to laugh. It's okay to get out there and poke some fun and laugh at yourself a little bit. I do think as Christians, it is important for us to have a sense, a good sense of humor. Because I do think there is a danger for young men, especially, to think, oh, Christians old and, you know, these elders in my church or whoever, old and stodgy and never know how to laugh or anything. And I think the and then they react with, well, I'm just going to tell whatever jokes, and they go too far sometimes. Right. They make the cuss words, the crass stuff, the punchlines of their life. So a good sense of humor is helpful in that it allows us to distinguish between, oh, that's legitimately funny and could be edifying and honoring to God, versus that's just a waste of time, the world lashing out. Anyway.
Yeah. And I think with that, you know, we have an opportunity to like I was saying, with the stand-up, the clean comics are able to make jokes that really last.
Right.
That are really able to have some weight and some carry. And yeah, like a joke that's actually funny, if I tell it now, it should really work 10 years from now.
Right.
You know, Stephen Wright tells a joke that he talks about like that, where he says, you know, it's a good joke because it carries, you know, it stands the test of time. He says, and Stephen Wright, if you've ever heard him, he's got this high nasal voice. He's from Boston, and he kind of really talks high and slow. Anyway, he does this bit where he goes, I went to a diner that served breakfast. They say serve breakfast at any time. So I got a French toast from the Renaissance.
Ha ha.
That was a fake laugh, ladies and gentlemen.
There you go.
He did not.
That's funny, Banjo.
That's funny. See how he hits that second syllable there on funny? That's funny. That's a giveaway. It wasn't. That's a clue. It's time for this old show to wrap up.
And that's what they said at the Alamo.
The other one I love is that I steal. You'll know this is one of those things that I stole from my personality. I love it when somebody's making a huge deal out of something. They're like, you know, and I wasn't able to, you know, get all of the deals that I wanted at the Black Friday thing. And then I do the Jerry Seinfeld. That's a shame. Just like the total deadpan.
Deadpan. That's a shame, man.
My favorite is when somebody thinks I'm being genuine, when they don't realize that I'm right? Thank you for this, for your sympathy.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. You're like,
glad I could help.
Yep. But. Well, good. Well, I did enjoy this discussion. I will say, I'm not sure. I think similar to last week's episode, I'm not sure going forward what habit there is to be formed out of this, or what kind of long-term pursuit other than, yeah, expose yourself to quality material, whether it's good writing or good movies or good, et cetera. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that, Banjo?
I think for me, it's going to, I mean, this is more of a personal habit, but, and I think all of our habits are kind of, you know, take them as you like them, you know, but for me, it's like, okay, I'm going to make it not a priority, but I'm going to make sure that I think for me, stand-up comedy is a little like vitamins. Like I should have it in my day somewhere, you know? And if I'm not getting enough, I think I take myself too seriously. I think I don't appreciate, you know, the danger of taking yourself too seriously is that you start to think that you're Nebuchadnezzar and you're like, oh, look at what I have made, you know?
Right.
I think we need the fools in life to say, hey, you're not such a big shot. Like you're not so important. And I think comedians are also great because I love wanting to be a comedian because I love making people laugh, not because I want to be the center of attention, but because I want to make people laugh. Like that's my favorite feeling is to laugh. So I want to make other people laugh, you know? So I think at its best, comedy is naturally not self-centered. You know, it's aimed at someone else. So for me, I think there's just little things like that, that I'm going to start taking into the day that I think is like, all right, you know, don't take yourself so seriously, learn to write a good joke and learn the importance of timing.
It's a long pause. All right. Go be your own court jester then, Banjo, and we'll see how that works out for you. All right, on to the next challenge. As a reminder, challenges last for 10 days. That is Monday through Friday for 2 weeks. They are simple daily tasks to grow us as men. And this next challenge is of my own, is my idea, although I've heard it many, many places, and it's something I've tried to implement in my life before and have failed many times. So trying again. It's get up at the same time every day. For some people, that's going to be a piece of cake because they have some place to be every day at the same time. For me, I work from home. I have the luxury of having the option to get up at different times. And even on days where I need to go into the office, they're later days than some other folks. So in my ideal world, instead of getting up at, you know, 7:30 and then starting work at 8, I'm up at like 5 or 6 and have the time for a workout and a good breakfast and all of that. Banjo, thoughts?
Well, I feel like I'm getting another freebie. I'm up at 5:30 every day already. So this one's going to be a little bit easier for me. I think nice. I am going to try and establish a better, maybe morning routine. Things that I feel like I ought to be doing in the morning that would be worthwhile that I'm not. So that's kind of where my focus is going to be. My recommendation for anyone who's starting out with this, who wants to do it, but maybe is not sure how to do it or anything like that, I'd recommend picking like a reasonable time. So the two
not
things that
4:30.
I go for, not 4:30. The two things that I go for are in a wake up time are, I think you should wake up early enough that you're able to have the morning you should have, if that makes sense. Like if you need a big breakfast, make sure you have enough time for that. You know, if you need 20 minutes for Bible reading or whatever it is you want to do, you should do that, or for your run, what have you. But on the other hand, don't kill yourself. Like I have found more often than not that when I try to wake up early, and if I choose a time that's too early, I'm only shooting myself in the foot. Because sleep is important and those circadian rhythms don't like to be interrupted.
It's true.
And so figure out, I think, where is that sweet spot? Like, where should you be for your ideal wake up time?
And part of that is honestly having a good bedtime.
Yes.
So I think that's going to be something I'm going to have to consider, but that's it. That's all there is to it.
This has been the Foraging Honor podcast. Music and production is by Elliot George. For more information about what we do or to learn how to get involved, visit our website at foraginghonor.com. If you enjoyed the show, make sure to like, subscribe, and give us a rating to bring others into the Foraging Honor journey.
On our website, you'll find information on how to do the challenges alongside us, as well as links to the many resources we mention in the show.
And we do make a small amount from any purchases you make through our website links, so thank you in advance.
Thanks for taking the time with us today. We hope you'll take up the work alongside us and join us in the task of Foraging Honor. We'll see you next time.